You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we're going to be continuing our discussion on food preservation. Now, this is a massive topic that we could spend probably 10 to 20 podcasts on, I'm sure.
Yes.
So for today, what we're going to do is talk about some overview
of just other methods.
Other methods. So aging and curing. Yeah, besides canning, which of course you can get in podcast 89.
Curing, okay, so, drying, freezing.
Yes, absolutely. We can definitely hit that, and we'll go into more detail later if that's necessary. But today, again, it's just an overview. There's lots of different food preservation methods. Now, you posted something on your page on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
That we're going to talk about today, just kind of as our success through action segment.
Yeah, probably a commercial, but it had a really good message.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what I was trying to share with everybody.
Right.
Not the car.
Not the car.
Not the snazzy car.
Not the snazzy car. Well, anyway, so can you just real quickly, what was the commercial or the message?
Yeah, well, the message was basically that, you know, the people who have become successful haven't done it through accident. They haven't come upon some luck.
They didn't get lucky.
Yeah, and it's been through a consistent action every single day. And, you know, facing your failures, and instead of looking at it like, oh, that's a huge failure, looking at it as a learning opportunity.
Right.
And getting better every day and growing every day and showing up and doing what you're supposed to be
Absolutely.
Doing.
Absolutely. One of the things that jumped out to me with that little video clip was that there was a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, as an entrepreneur, you're starting up, there's always going to be rejection, criticism. What makes, you know, things like, well, why should I listen to you? And, you know, all of that. So we need to overcome that, not be afraid of rejection. In fact, if you expect it,
then it's not a major blow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So, I don't know. Yeah, it was a cool little video, and it was motivating.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, obviously, with us starting up our businesses over this last year, we've had some success and we've had some setbacks. And, you know, with those setbacks, we've looked at it, we've gotten a little more creative and tried a different avenue or just continued pushing what we were doing and the way we were doing it, just being a little bit more patient and saying, it will come, it will happen, we just have to keep going.
Right, or and also not being afraid to see other opportunities. Like, you know what, well, this isn't working out so well, so we can either do one of two things. We can switch directions or relook at how we're approaching this enterprise.
Right, and you know, I think, I can't remember who it was that said this, but it's like so many of the people that don't succeed stop right before. And it seems like there's always this huge problem or there's really a major obstacle get over. And if you can just get over that, suddenly success takes off. But a lot of people stop right there and they say, oh, this is huge. I can't overcome it. And they just give up. And success could have been right around the corner.
Right. So, you know, the great examples are Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Edison with all their different inventions. How many times did they fail? You know, it was 10,000 times.
Yeah, the Wright brothers.
Right.
Inventing their airplane. They failed a lot.
So, yeah, the message then is don't give up. Keep going.
Keep going.
Stick-to-itiveness and just simply show up.
Yeah.
Show up every day. Eventually, you're going to get a breakthrough.
Yep. Focus on your goals and keep moving.
Absolutely.
Don't
keep
stop.
Moving.
Yeah.
That's so important. Okay, let's talk about a worldview topic today, and we're going to briefly talk about the upcoming election, the upcoming presidential election. And, of course, if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you will know right away that we put a whole lot more emphasis on local politics than on national politics.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still important to talk about. And so, by way of review, I think that the local election for sheriff is about 10 times more important than the presidential election.
Well, yeah, your sheriff is representing the very local people and enforcing whatever laws he thinks.
Or standing up to any type of tyrannical laws that may come down. So you can have a good sheriff, which we are fortunate to have here, or a terrible one that's more than happy to go along with
Yeah, and we've seen good sheriffs stand up against the federal government when they are overstepping their bounds and taking away the rights of the people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now, we still want to comment on national politics. It's not that we don't participate in national politics, although, you know, we're highly suspect of legitimacy.
Yeah, of the election.
Of the election, and is it rigged, and is there fraud? We know there's fraud. I don't know to what extent all this happens, or if there's a lot of theories out there about elections being rigged, and the one thing we know for sure is you do not put anything past government.
Right.
Okay, government is capable of all kinds of evil, so it is entirely possible. I'm not saying that the elections are rigged. We do know for a fact that there's lots of voter fraud, and there's rigging on individual levels. I just don't know if it's a systematic.
Well, yeah, and I'm not saying this is necessarily part of a larger plan, although it definitely could be. But when you see, you know, in the news and on media, only particular chosen ones that are given positive, you know, positive time, whereas either their name isn't ever mentioned. I can say Rand Paul is hardly ever mentioned in the media.
Right.
Or if he is mentioned, it's very negative.
Yeah.
There's not positive things being said about
right.
really valid candidates who would stand up for the liberty of people.
Right. And we mentioned this the other, actually last podcast, as we went over all these isms and we talked about the state of our country and our culture and how we have embraced a lot of these really terrible isms, that both parties to varying degrees engage in these isms. Both parties are statist. Both parties have high degrees of secular humanism, socialism embedded in them now. Okay. So there is no big difference between the two parties. And, you know, they make it appear like there's lots of differences.
Right. Well, one of the, you could use, you know, Democrats usually say we're not pro-war, you know, we're going to pull back
right.
on that.
We're the party of peace.
Party of peace. But we haven't seen that in Obama's
yeah.
time.
No.
Now we're in Syria.
He's engaged in just as much war as the previous presidents, you know, et cetera. The Nobel Peace Prize winner is, quite frankly, engaged in war just as much as anyone else.
Yeah. You know, but that's,
no,
that,
no
that
boots
change,
on the ground.
Right, but it
Iraq
doesn't change the message they say. They
Correct.
Say the same message and yet act totally different on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. And now we have boots on the ground.
We have boots
in
the ground
Iraq
in Syria.
And Syria. Again.
Yeah.
Again. And so even some degree of non-interventionism has escaped us. We are completely interventionist to our demise.
Well, yeah, we're stretched so thin.
Yeah, and just
the amount of money that's coming out.
I mean, we could go on about this for hours, but our foreign policy is schizophrenic and it makes no sense. But make no mistake, there is some agenda. You know that there is some agenda in it. They are trying to achieve certain things. It's not just incoherent on the surface, but when we look at both parties and we look at the presidential election, honestly, I'm not impressed with almost anyone. You know, the Republican candidates, most of them talk pretty good on certain subjects, but the reality is that the Republican Party has not held to its principles. And of course, you know, now that it's election season, they're all talking about principles and everything else. But I don't see it. So what it comes down to, and just full disclosure, we are not registered Republicans. Of course, we're not registered Democrats.
No.
you know, we're independent. We're registered independent. Now, who could I support? Who could I support? I could support Rand Paul. I could support mm-hmm. Rand Paul, not because I agree with everything or every policy he believes in or everything he says, but the vast majority of the things that he says and talks about are liberty-minded, they're constitutional, and you know, this kind of responsible government. It's smaller government, truly smaller government. It's much like his dad, Ron Paul. was very consistent. Okay, so that's we could support him. Now, we're not out beating the streets. We're not signing up for Rand Paul's campaign because, again, the local sheriff election is much more important than that. But we just want to give you our take on the upcoming elections.
And, you know, one of the things that you need to do before you go into elections is be knowledgeable. Look at their voting records. Know who you're voting for and on different topics that are going to greatly affect our government, whether it's about education, immunizations, their stand on homosexuality. I mean, all of those things are going to affect us on a national level. How about where do they stand economically? What is their views?
Are they going to continue the same foreign policy?
Yeah. What are their views on foreign policy?
What are their views on responsible government? Are they going to continue to spend out of control?
Yeah. And now the best way to know that is not to listen to them, but to actually look at where they've signed their name and their voting record.
Exactly. No, not what they say,
not
what they've
done.
Okay. Let's move on. Let's move to our main topic, which again is a continuation of food preservation. Again, a massive topic. And last time we hit on kind of narrow down into water bath and
pressure canning.
And today we're going to kind of just do a quick overview of some of the other methods of food preservation. You know, and we don't have the time to go into great detail on each one of these individually. Like, you could spend an entire podcast at least on salt curing, for example, or even just freezer, because freezing is much more than just, oh, well, we throw it in the freezer. We have meat in the freezer. There's a whole lot more to it. There's, you know, what's actually happening with the meat is, you know, the bacteria is not dead. It's just slowed down. You know, and how do you package to get maximum preservation out of a freezer? You know, what types of cuts will last longer than others in the method of processing, etc. So there's a lot more to it.
Yes.
Than that. So we'll briefly cover these things and then maybe go into some detail on some future podcasts.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know. Where do you want to start? You want to just pick one, or what do you want to talk about just in general food preservation?
Well, why don't we start with dehydrating? Because that's, besides, I think, canning, dehydrating or drying your food is probably one of the most commonly used ones in a household on a homestead. Most people I do know that are on a homestead have a dehydrator that they use. Now, you don't have to have a dehydrator, but it does make the process a whole lot easier. Dehydrating food, you can dehydrate anything. Fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, meats.
Your jerkies.
I guess not everything, but
just about.
Yeah, you can't dehydrate milk, but
correct.
they do have dried milk, but you can't do that in a home dehydrator.
Right.
But the one thing about drying is that this is a process that has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
This is not a new type of food preservation, whereas canning has really only been around for about 100 years. Maybe a little bit more, but right around this. So that's a fairly new form of food preservation.
The automobile has been around essentially longer, or about the same time.
About the same time, yeah. Whereas drying or dehydrating has been around for thousands of years. I mean, people have done it for a long, long time. So this has great potential for preserving food and preserving its nutritive value. So, you know, if you have a dehydrator that can go really low, about 85, all the way up to 180, you have a dehydrator that can dehydrate everything from herbs, which are, if you have it at too high of a temperature, will damage the herbs and they won't dehydrate correctly. All the way up to 180, you're talking meats, where you can start making jerkies and things like that. So
so you're going higher temperature.
Well, it's going to do it a little bit quicker to decrease the time that the bacteria has to start growing and then rotting the meat. If you do it at too low of a temperature without doing salting and things like that, you're going to end up with rotting food.
Okay.
So you need to have a higher temperature. Now, the cheaper dehydrators that are out there, a lot of them won't allow you to go up to that level. So you need to make sure that if you're thinking about dehydrating meat, you're looking at a little bit higher of a model.
Okay. So you're looking for a good range
yeah.
as far as temperatures.
Yes. And, you know, the other thing is I do have a recommendation for a dehydrator, but there are a lot of good ones out there. The main thing that I would tell people to look at if they're looking to invest in a dehydrator is removable trays that allow you to put higher, you know, taller items in okay. or make more space between.
Okay.
I have two types of dehydrators, and one of them is a round, and the air comes out from the bottom. To okay. the top and then disperses through. The other one, the air comes directly from behind and evenly distributes the air
okay.
through all of those trays.
Right.
That's the one that is going to be the most versatile for you because you can raise bread in it, you can make yogurt in it, you can dehydrate fruits, vegetables, and go all the way up to jerkies. You can make fruit roll-ups. I mean, things like that. So you have a little bit more versatility with that type of dehydrator.
Okay.
But if you have the round one or you have one that dehydrates from the bottom up, you could still use that for a lot of things, maybe not meat, though.
Okay. All right. So that's pretty cool. And how about, do you know in general the nutritional value of dehydrated food?
Well, actually, that's a really great thing about dehydrating is that it does maintain the very similar nutritional value to a fresh food.
Yeah, that makes it an excellent way of preserving food.
Yes, it really does. And the use of these is great because when you've got, say, dehydrated mushrooms, I don't know anybody who just sits there and eats dehydrated mushrooms, but you can throw them into a soup or a stew and they, after getting all the liquid back in, act just like a regular mushroom did.
Like a fresh mushroom. That's excellent. Yeah. As opposed to, like we talked about last time, canning, there is some nutritional loss.
Yes, there is. Nutritional loss, and then it also changes the texture of the food.
Yes.
You know, when you're preserving, especially things like vegetables or fruit, I mean, you're changing the texture of the vegetable or fruit
right.
when you're canning, and you can keep it more with dehydrating.
Okay. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit for the preparedness-minded individuals out there that always are worried about storage and shelf life and that. Dehydrated foods, no preservatives, we're not putting chemicals and all that garbage in our foods. What are we looking at as far as shelf life? And I know that kind of depends, but can you break that down for us?
It does. Well, one of the things I'm going to mention right now is that when you're dehydrating fruits, one of the best ways to keep them from browning is to pre-treat them with ascorbic acid, which actually is vitamin C.
Okay.
And so you'll be increasing the vitamin C in that food too, which is never a bad thing, especially in the winter months.
Okay, so lemon juice.
You could use lemon juice, but literally you can go out and get pure vitamin C powder tablets. They do sell it, I think, in canning areas too, but just break it open and put some of that into your water. So as you're cutting the fruits, you just throw them right into the water, let them sit, and then you strain them and then dry them.
Okay.
It's pretty simple. But shelf life, if you have a well-dried fruit, something that's not pliable, it's...
So like a dried banana, the kind of chips, crispy, banana chips.
Yeah, a crispy thing. Then that will last longer than a pliable one. So that probably, as long as you package it correctly, about a year.
Okay.
So it's not a terribly long time, but certainly enough to get you through winter and spring until you start having another harvest the following summer and fall.
Absolutely.
If they are more pliable and less dehydrated, then you're going to lose.
So like the dried apples that are pliable and they've got a little bit of moisture, they still have a little bit of moisture.
They do. And then because they have moisture, then you could have possible mold growth.
Okay.
So that will last a little less, probably actually quite a bit less. So within a few weeks to a couple of months, you'd probably want to be using those.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is packaging. If you, let's say you dried 20 pounds of peaches and you decide to put them all into the same bag. Now, every time you go to use some peaches, you're going to be opening that bag, allowing moisture and oxygen to get into the bag and pulling things out and then shutting it back up. And every time you put your hand in, you're introducing bacteria because your hands are never fully clean, even if you wash them. So one of the best things to do to extend your shelf life of your fruits and vegetables is to package them in packages that you know you'll be using that whole thing.
Okay, so just kind of like what you were talking about as far as right-sizing canning jars and things for your family.
Yeah, you want to do the same thing with these bags. And if you've got some fruit, now if you're going to use it in a couple weeks, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. But if you're wanting this to last for a long time and you want to give yourself, oh, I want to be able to use this over 6 months and I want to be able to grab some of those apples, don't package them all together. Just pick out some individual sized bags or do the vacuum seal bags and you can choose your own size then. And make them just appropriate. Now, vacuum and sealing will also extend your shelf life.
Okay, because so, you're removing all of the oxygen.
Right, it's all out and it's sitting there. And as long as you don't open it, it can last for a long time.
Right. It's kind of like when we process birds for customers, you shrink wrap bags to make sure that all the oxygen is out.
Yeah, all the air is out, and that's going to prevent freezer burn and other issues that you would have in the freezer.
Okay. All right, so you want to move on?
Sure.
What are we going to talk about next?
How about fermenting?
Fermenting, this is one of your favorites, isn't
it? Yeah, it really is. Last winter, I practiced fermenting a lot of different things, including ginger bugs. So I made like my own ginger ale type drink. We did sourdough, which
kombucha.
Was... Yeah, kombucha.
And then, of course, sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut. Sauerkraut was delicious, and I ended up canning a lot of that this summer, just making the sauerkraut, and it's naturally fermented just using salt and water.
Okay.
And
well, what do you mean? What is fermentation?
Fermentation is the action of lactobacillus, which is an enzyme.
Okay.
It's a type of bacteria, but it's a healthy bacteria, and it breaks down the vegetable, permeates through, and ferments it into kind of a tart, tangy product that is now safe from
sauerkraut.
The bad enzymes. Yeah, or things like kimchi.
Yeah.
Or it's basically like sauerkraut, only you put a lot of really great spices in there. And this is an age-old...
it's been happening.
For a long time. And I think it was probably accidentally discovered.
Sure.
They tried to store their cabbage, and it turned into this sour product, and you were like, huh, that's
somebody tried it.
Somebody tried it. I'm always curious how things got started, but
there was there's a museum in Korea,
a kimchi museum,
you know, how they used to use clay pots. They'd just put them in the ground, throw all their vegetables in, cover it up, and just I don't know, come back a couple months later,
and then the process is done. Yeah, and honestly, when I first started looking into fermentation, especially making sauerkraut, I thought, wow, that's actually a lot easier than I had thought it would be. And getting yourself you have to have kind of the right equipment, a crock and things, because you don't want to be using metal when you're fermenting food. But, you know, just the basic principle is keep the vegetable underneath the water, the salt water brine solution. And if it comes up, it's now exposed to air and doesn't have the same, you know, it'll get some rot on there. You can pull it off, but to be real careful when you're fermenting and keep it immersed.
Yeah, and this is unique in that doesn't it increase in nutritional value?
It does. It increases in nutritional value, and it's really good for, it's full of probiotics and really good for your gut health.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And once you get it fermented, then,
of course, there's also beers and ciders and wines. Okay, this is fermentation.
Yeah, and yogurt, another form of fermentation. Once with fermented things besides wine and beer, those are long lasting. But sauerkraut either needs to be refrigerated and used within a few weeks, or it can be canned. Water bath canned because it's an acidic food.
Okay.
So
all right,
and that's what I did. I made way too much sauerkraut for us to eat in just a few weeks.
So that's why you canned it. Okay, so it's preserved on its own, but only for a few weeks.
Yeah.
You're not adding preservatives and things like that.
No.
Okay.
No, but once you can it, it's good.
Yeah. Then it
for
goes into
time.
Your canning shelf life.
Yes.
Okay, very cool. All right. So, yeah, fermentation. We've done a lot of that around here.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to do a lot more this winter. The one thing that I had a lot of different things fermenting in the kitchen, and the thing you have to be careful of is to make sure that each individual thing is at least 4 feet away from another thing that's fermenting.
Okay.
So kombucha, they will share spores, and they'll contaminate each other.
Okay.
I did not know that at first, and then I discovered there was some things growing in my kombucha, and I thought, what is going on? I had a ginger bug right near it fermenting, ginger fermenting, yeah. And I was like, oh, they're...
Cross-contaminating.
Cross-contaminating.
You know, okay, so lesson learned there.
Yeah, and so I just moved everything, my sourdough starter, my kombucha, my ginger bug, sauerkraut, all at least 4 feet away from each other in the kitchen.
That's a good tip.
Yeah.
Okay, let's actually talk about freezing, because again, we briefly discussed this, that there's a lot more to it than just throwing your stuff in the freezer.
Well, yeah, and freezing is probably the most common form of food storage today. Now, we know that freezing food is great during a time that we have cheap energy and everything is going great.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to also have backup methods and food that is spread out in ways that you've preserved it in in a variety of ways.
For the vast majority of people, they have put all their meat in one freezer.
Yes.
You know, all their eggs in one basket, all their meat in one freezer. That is their sole and entire food preservation plan. Of course, they probably buy canned vegetables and meats. But as far as being able to preserve food yourself, most people only rely on the freezer.
Right. And then there's also to make sure that your freezer is the right temperature. I don't know that many people even think about that. About it being cool enough to really slow down the breakdown process of the meat and the pathogens that are in meat. It's important to make sure it's fully frozen.
Yes. Yeah, because the bacteria doesn't actually stop growing, contrary to popular belief. It's just slowed down to a crawl, like we talked about. Now, before we talk about freezing, let's just briefly mention that when you process your own meat, like we do here, it's important to let that meat rest for the enzymes to be able to break down the meat to overcome the rigor mortis. It doesn't matter if we're talking about a rabbit or a deer or a goat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all have different resting times, as we like to say. And we rest it in the refrigerator, which we try between 35 and 40 degrees, you know, as far as... Now, everyone understands that, hunters, they hang their deer in their garages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's fine as long as you can maintain the right temperature. And in fact, many times, we will do this. We do this. We did it last winter. We'll do it again this winter. There is a time period where our garage becomes the perfect temperature. It just maintains itself between 35 and 40 degrees.
Yeah, and if we see it getting even up to 37 or 38,
we'll
open
the doors and we'll make sure that it stays there. And so there are times when, depending on where you live, that you can use your garage or any other hanging space as long as you can keep animals out of there. As a large refrigerator.
Yes.
Before you break it down into its cuts and process it. And freeze it. Okay, so now we're not going to go into all the details, but just to give you a quick example, we usually let a deer, say, rest for 7 or 8 days, whereas a rabbit only needs to rest for 12, 20 to 24 hours. We do 48 hours. We do all of our small game at 48 hours.
Right, and so that's what I was going to mention. The smaller the animal, the less resting time would be required. And the larger the animal, you want to let them rest longer.
Right. And then the more domesticated the animal, the less time it needs. So, again, wild game versus domesticated game, there's a slight difference. But generally speaking, that is exactly right. Larger game, longer. Smaller game, less. Less time.
Unless you're buying that aged beef, which is like aged 30 days or whatever. Yeah, I mean,
so a lot of people say, well, you can't keep meat out of a freezer for 7 days. You can't do that. Think about this. You go to the fanciest restaurant out there and you get yourself an aged beef.
Yeah.
Well, what is that? What is an aged beef? Well, that's exactly what it is. It's something that was rested for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And in fact, the outer crust, it almost develops a crust that's dried or dehydrated that they trim off. And then underneath is this super
really
tender
meat.
Okay, so that's what aging is. And it's important because, again, it breaks down the meat. It makes it more tender.
So that's what you would do for preparation for before you freeze meat. Now,
right.
Preparation before you freeze, like, fruits and vegetables, you'd have to look up each individual vegetable because there are different directions for different vegetables. But many of them you need to blanch.
Okay.
So you need to put it very quickly in some hot water and then drop it into cold water. And then if you want it to stay separated, to lay it out on parchment paper and freeze it on like a cookie sheet or
right.
whatever.
And then you can put it in your final package.
Yes, then you put it in your packaging and make sure it's sealed and all of that.
Okay, so we briefly mentioned that freezing, of course, is a great food preservation method, but it's not very resilient. It's great as long as you have power.
As long as you have power. And you know, the optimal temperature for a freezer is zero. Most of your refrigerator-freezer combos, the freezer generally doesn't go that low. So they do recommend getting a standalone freezer if you're looking to preserve that meat as long as you possibly can in
the
freezer.
Yeah, we have chest freezers. In fact,
chest
freezers generally are better than upright freezers. And of course, you're going to be able to hold those temperatures better.
Yeah.
Okay, so freezing, you know, we talked again about getting the right freezer. Again, we recommend chest freezers and standalones so that you can get the maximum food preservation from it.
Well, and you know, the other thing with freezing is it really does maintain, again, the nutritional value of food very much like dehydrating. I mean, the freezing, you're pretty much getting a one-for-one nutritional value from fresh food to frozen food. It's not, you know, I know people think, oh, if I don't eat fresh food, I'm not getting all the nutrition that I would normally get out of that food. And that is true of canned foods, especially as you get into things like beans, you know, green beans.
Yeah.
But when you're getting frozen green beans, unless you overcook them, you're getting the same nutritional value that you would if you were eating fresh.
Yeah, that's really important. It's more important is where did that come from?
Yeah.
Where did that food come from? I mean,
we're assuming
you can
that
take
you
a fresh cut of meat from that's processed and it's got garbage in it.
Yeah,
I will take my frozen goat any day
yes,
over that.
Of course, yeah, and that's I think the assumption. But you know, to be careful where you're getting your products from that you're preserving, whether it's freezing or canning or dehydrating.
All right, so most meat that you're going to put in the freezer, we're going to assume now it's properly rested, it's going in the freezer. Packaging is super important.
Yes.
As far as preservation, you can throw it in a Ziploc bag.
We have.
But that's something that's going to be used quicker.
Precisely. If you're freezing it in a freezer bag that you got at the grocery store, then just assume for yourself that you're going to be using that quicker than things that you've maybe vacuum sealed.
Right.
Or wrapped in a proper freezer
paper. Because you've removed the oxygen, mm-hmm. right? For example, you might say, well, what is freezer burning? We know when our meat has been freezer burned, but what is it? Well, it's just a form of dehydration and oxidation. Okay, so the oxygen has been introduced because it's been exposed to air.
Right.
So you get the Ziploc bag that's got a little bit of air in it and things. So it's going to do a little bit of dehydration, a little bit of oxidization.
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, some of the things that have happened to our vegetables in the past, and this is, again, careful bagging to make sure you're getting the proper size bag for your product. Because if you stored, let's say you did it in a proper bag, and you pulled all that air out, you know, you vacuum sealed it, but you put so much that you had to open it to get your, you know, one serving or your six servings for dinner that night. And now you roll it back down. I don't even know what you would do. Roll it back down and clip it. All that air is getting into your vegetables now, and you're going to end up with freezer burn.
Right. And so if you just think of it like this, like there's a maximum time that, say, a roast will keep in a freezer over time. Well, every time that you have an exposure, mm-hmm. you're reducing that time.
Yes.
And you might be taking off, oh, that just took off 2 months. That just took off 3 months.
Yeah, I know probably every cook out there has experienced this. When you go in and get your roast, or usually a roast type thing, and there's a hole
yeah.
in the bag. And there's now darkness, and it's really dry in that area. You've got to cut it off. Well, now you're nervous about the whole thing.
Right.
It's like, well, how long has this been torn? How long has it been open? So those are things that I've gotten from the grocery store in the past, where the packaging is that thinner plastic, and that really doesn't last very long. So making sure that when you're doing it, you're using some stuff that can stand up to a little bit of dropping and abuse and kids not being careful.
And the lesson learned there is, again, right-sizing your cuts. So if you're processing your own animals, you don't want to cut a giant roast if you're not going to be able to cook all of that at one time.
Right, yeah.
So whatever you pull out of the freezer, you want to use.
Yes, because as soon as it starts defrosting, that food needs to be used. We, as a matter of fact, had an experience last year when we had goats that had kitted, and we needed an extension cord, and we told one of our kids, go get an extension cord from the garage. Now, they were in a rush. I don't know exactly what was happening. We had extension cords hanging on the wall, but he decided to unplug the freezer and use that extension cord without telling us. So we had, our kids nice and toasty warm in the barn with their light, but then it was 3 days later before I went to get any food. Now, fortunately, we had a really good freezer that kept things, but our meat started defrosting.
Yeah.
And vegetables, fruit. I had to cook it all that day.
Right.
And I actually did a huge freezer meal prep then. I was like, okay, I'm going to sit here and cook for 2 weeks
right.
in my kitchen today and repackage it in pre-cooked foods and then put that back into the freezer.
Yes, and the answer we got after questioning this terrible decision was, I was going to plug it back in, but I forgot.
Yeah. But so if that situation happens to you, I would suggest, now that it's started to defrost, cook it. Just cook it.
Yeah, and I guess if you needed to, you can pressure can it then.
Yeah, you could pressure can it.
Just put it in and pressure can it.
Yes, and you can cook it, and once it's cooked, you can do a refreeze. That's okay, but don't go, oh, it's partially defrosted, oh, I'm going to refreeze it.
Right.
Because the health of that meat has been compromised, and it's already been degraded. So use it.
Now, one of the things as far as freezing is the importance of rapid freezing, if possible. And to give you an example, commercial freezers, commercial guys that are doing this, they have freezers that are set at negative 30 degrees. To get that rapid freezing, they're trying to kill the pathogens, and they're trying to avoid dehydration, if that's the method they're going to use. Now, we don't have those luxuries, but being diligent and when it's time, get that stuff in the freezer right away, in order to do what you can.
Yes, and the other thing is, because we have getting venison, so you've butchered all the venison. And it's ready to go in the freezer. If I stacked it all together in the freezer in one place, especially if I had to use just the small freezer above my refrigerator, that's not only going to take a long time to cool down, but it's going to start warming up everything around it. So really an important policy that you have to adhere to when you're putting new things in your freezer, spread it out. Spread it out. Get it as far away from each other as possible. Spread it out so that it can...
Rapid freezing as much as possible.
So it can get cold as quickly as possible.
Okay. Yeah. And then, of course, constant temperature is important.
Yeah.
If you can control that. And it's hard to control that with just your standard stand-up freezer. You really don't know.
Well, it is. And especially if it's inside and it's one that the kids use frequently to get ice or to get something out of the freezer. That makes it much harder. Our chest freezer... we go into maybe once a day. Sometimes not even once a day.
Right.
It depends on if we need access to some things that are frozen, but that is easier to keep temperature controlled than the ones that are sitting at the refrigerator.
Yeah, and in fact, that it could be unplugged for 3 days and still everything is actually frozen.
Yeah, just starting to defrost. It
tells you something right there.
Yeah, it was much better.
Now, one thing I want to mention real quick, because I know we talked about resting meat and then talked about getting everything in the freezer. organs, when you process your own animals, organs are a little different. With the organs, they have a whole lot more enzymes in them, so they break down much quicker. So in other words, you know, you have the deer hanging in the garage for 7 days. Well, you wouldn't want to do that with organs.
Right.
Organs actually go straight into the freezer if you're going to use them. And they can be broken down, whether it's you're going to make stock or whether they're going to be dog food or whatever. So you take the organs. I don't care if you're processing a chicken or a deer. Take the organs, get them chilled as quickly as possible, and get them in the freezer. Okay? And then we've talked about right sizing in the freezer, of course. Your leaner cuts store longer. So the more fatty the meat,
yes, the quicker they're going to break down.
Quicker it's going to break down. All right. And
the more you've cut the meat, the quicker it's going to break down. If you've got ground beef.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That is going to last a whole lot less than a roast.
Right.
So that's important. And cooked meats don't last as long. You're not going to be able to take a cooked meat and keep it in the, you know, in other words, if you're going to do 30 day cooking,
use it within 30 days.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're not going to want to keep that for a year.
Right. No. It's why it's not like 60 day cooking. It's a 30 day cooking. And it is, I have bumped into meat that I've cooked, I don't know, 2 or 3 months before and thought, oh, gosh, I didn't see this. So I'm just going to use it. And it just didn't, it had a different texture. It didn't taste as good. There was nothing rotten about it. It just wasn't as fresh.
Right.
Tasting.
Okay. So we mentioned air tightness. So again, removing as much oxygen as possible, hopefully all of it, you know, through vacuum sealing or shrink wrapping or, you know, but again, like you said, if you're going to use it within a week or two.
Right. Then it's not as vital, but you still, you should make sure that especially your meats are packaged very well.
Yeah. Okay. I think we went kind of off on freezing a little bit. Didn't mean to. We were just trying to do an overview. So why don't we move on to something else? So we've talked about, we've talked about fermentation and freezing and drying. Anything else we want to
talk about? There's curing.
Yes, let's talk about that because this is important. It's a great skill if you can learn it and do it on your own. But it's also, if say you take large animals, say you take a cow and you take it to a processor, a custom shop, that you understand enough about it, or a hog or whatever, where you want to get certain things cured, smoked, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about curing.
Basic curing. Curing really is applying salt. You can do it in either a dry cure or a wet cure. Now the dry is literally putting salt on it, and as
like a thick rub.
Basically. Yeah, very thick. You're really covering it in salt, and so what's happening is the salt is moving in, and the moisture is coming out.
Okay.
And as the moisture removes, it's also removing bacterial,
right.
the environment that it needs to grow.
Right.
You're trying to dehydrate it, basically. Yeah. So today, things are a little bit different than they did originally. I mean, they used to have barrels where they would pack meat in there and then put thick salt between each level.
On our last trip, we went to the Oregon coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the Explorer. Was it Lewis,
was
and Lewis Clark?
And Clark.
Okay,
yeah,
fine. It was Lewis and Clark. And how they camped near the ocean because, of course, they were using salt water to cure their meats.
Yes. Well, they were using salt. And actually what they did
They
took the salt, cook it down, and then took that salt to cure their meats for their trip.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the old school. I mean, really. And
you can do it.
But it is a lot of work because you have to repack those every day to pull away the moisture and to put more salt in. And then you have to have holes in the bottom of your barrel. I mean, it's old school.
But that's what they had.
That's what
they
had.
They did it. They managed to preserve meat.
Yes. Today we do have curing
mixtures.
Yeah. Okay. They do include
brine solutions.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they do include nitrates. But nitrates are present in almost every vegetable out there.
Okay, what's the difference between a nitrate and a nitrite?
Nitrite is the byproduct of nitrate acting with the enzymes that are on the meat.
Okay.
So it will change to a nitrite. Even when you have spinach, which has nitrates in it, you put it in your mouth, start chewing it, the enzymes from your saliva interact with it and changes that to a nitrite.
Okay, so well, what
this
about...
This is naturally occurring, as long as you have it in small amounts.
Because a lot of our food that's processed commercially has got loads of nitrites in them.
Yes.
Right?
And not only that, it's also the way they're processing it and where the meat comes from. I mean, when you talk about, you know, decreased health or increased risk of cancer from all this processed foods, you know, hot dogs and all right. that, there's a lot of just mystery stuff in sure. those. It's not just the nitrates. And I think they've looked and they said, oh, see, it's the nitrates. That's the problem. But we have nitrates throughout all of our food.
Right.
So it's not that, it's the amounts they're using and it's the other things that are being just pushed into whatever mystery meat you happen to yeah. be eating.
So like you can go to a custom processor and say, hey, I don't want nitrites or I want a low amount of nitrites.
Yeah. And a lot of custom meat processors, guys yeah. are going to use very little.
Right.
Because yeah. they're not the commercial guys out there just packaging this meat without care. These are people that they see. They're right. interacting with them, and they care about the product.
They go to their farms and pick up the carcasses.
Yes.
And, you know.
They care about the finished product, and they want their customers to be healthy and happy.
Yeah.
So you're going to be dealing with a lot better of curing and
yeah. Okay, so you actually mentioned the dry and wet curing. Could you talk about that a little bit more? I mean, are we literally just talking about solutions versus a rub?
Yeah, we really are. Okay. The brine, you would put... Now, you can put sugars and things like that in your brine that you would make sure that your meat is fully submersed in that water, but you would have to refrigerate it. That's
yeah,
not
okay.
the kind of thing... You have to keep it refrigerated while you're brining, and probably even afterwards, you'd have to keep it refrigerated or frozen. So it's not... There are very few meats out there.
It's not preserving the food. You're not going to go then put that turkey on the shelf in your cellar.
No.
Okay.
But you can salt, just dry salt food and then smoke it. Then you would have a shelf stable food.
Okay.
But like when you're doing fish, even smoked fish and salted fish, that is not a shelf stable food and it will last maybe 2 weeks. So fish, I think probably because of the high fats, will break down faster.
Sure. Yeah. Right, because it's the fat that actually makes it rot first.
Yeah. So it's curing is something that we are going to
get more into
this next
sure.
year.
Yeah.
Doing all the salting and build a smokehouse.
Oh, yeah,
so
absolutely.
That we can
That's coming.
Really become experts at doing this, and we don't have to go to anybody to
yeah.
do any processing of any of our meat.
Right. How about smoking? How about... talking about just a little bit, of course, we know that is also something that has been used for thousands of years. It's also a good method of dehydration. There's a lot of rumors around, like, oh, it's bad for you.
Well, I think that came out because, you know, we're so used to, we want clean air, and we think that somehow smoke from a fire is somehow not clean. And I don't agree with the unhealthiness
you're thinking
of smoked meat.
That, again, it depends on how it was processed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What is more important than smoking it or not smoking it?
Yeah. And, you know, again, what I was talking about yesterday, you know, learning these skills before you need them.
Right.
Learning the skills before you need them. And smoking and curing, fermenting and dehydrating. Even if you aren't necessarily going to do this on a large scale, but challenging yourself to learn, to just learn the skill and know how to do it, have the materials necessary to be able to do it in a time that maybe you have to do it.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we stop there? I mean, that was a very good overview on a lot of different methods of food preservation.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else to add?
Nope. I think that's it.
All right. Our scripture for today comes from Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast, Semper Fidelis, and Soli Deo Gloria.